Welcome everyone to our meeting. My name is Lisa Wiest and I'm here with the rest of the leadership of Blood Cancer Uncensored. We have Adrian and Sue, Lynn and Phil, who I don't know if he is on. And all of our attendees, we thank you because you make our group possible. And I am thrilled to present a special Ask the Doc event today as we host Dr. Shahzad Mustafa. Dr. Mustafa graduated from the University at Buffalo School of Medicine and Dentistry in 2004 and has practiced medicine in the Rochester area for 18 years now. He is currently chief physician of allergy, immunology, and rheumatology, and was head of the team managing outpatient COVID therapeutics at Rochester Regional Health, as well as clinical professor of medicine with the University of Rochester, also here in Rochester, New York. He has co-published several articles which are found on PubMed, such as the use of 20% subcut therapy in patients with B-cell non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which I'm going to read after this, and has recently been a guest expert speaker on both CLL Society and Leukemia Lymphoma Society, giving helpful information on the immune system and blood cancers and how this relates to the COVID-19 pandemic. Please note, this is a Q&A only, and we have a large group here. In order to include everyone who has a question, we will present the questions in rounds. We will have round one, where everyone who wants to ask a question gets to ask, then on to round two and perhaps round three, depending on time. So while the doctor introduces himself, please put your question in the chat unless you've done that already. And I will call on you when it is your turn to ask a question. One suggestion is to use your what you think is your best question first in the event we run out of time. So one question per round, as others may actually have the same question. And please stay muted when you're not speaking. Okay, so you will have a chance to speak and be aware that that will become part of our recording today. Therefore, it is my pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Mustafa for our special Q&A on Blood Cancer Uncensored. Dr. Mustafa, we are so pleased that you could join us today.
Well, thank you very, very much, Lisa, and for the whole crew for having me. That was a very official introduction, very kind. And I love the rounds. I can't wait for Final Jeopardy. I wonder what happens then. So it's a real pleasure to be here. I do allergy and clinical immunology. So this morning I actually gave another talk. My kids are like, why are you working on a Saturday? I gave a talk on food allergies, which is quite the opposite of cancer and lymphoma and leukemia. So it's a really fun specialty. We take care of children and adults. My research interest is secondary immune deficiency, so impact on the immune system from blood cancers and chemotherapy. And we have research projects going in that space. Like Lisa mentioned, we have been lucky enough to publish some, and we have a lot of work to do. So it's a real pleasure to be here, and I love this format. I give lots of talks, and I hate hearing myself speak, and I don't love slides. So I love the Q&A format, because who knows better than you of what you want to know? So I'm happy to address that. I'm going to do it without slides, obviously, but I promise all of my answers will be evidence-based based on the most recent research. And I may not know the answer to some of your questions, and then I might make something up, or I'll just tell you I don't know the answer to your question, because maybe the answer doesn't exist, because it is a fast-moving time, especially in the world of COVID. So I love the questions I'm seeing in the chat, Lisa. So how do we want to roll? I'm ready. Round one. Let's do this.
Well, I see that Adrian has asked a question, so I'd like to have Adrian repeat his question and tell us what kind of cancer he has. Keep paying attention.
Adrian went off video, so maybe he has a phone call.
Oh yeah, he might have lost his signal. Let's go on to Barbell. Barbell, will you ask your question? And tell Dr. Mustafa where you're from and stuff too, because
okay.
I think I warned him about you.
Oh, I'm from Germany, and I've had treatment twice, and I always get funny looks when I talk to my doctors and say that actually I'm not done when I'm with the treatment because my immune system isn't perfect yet. And so what I want to know is, do you recommend CLL patients to consult an immunologist, oh, what a word, too, before, during, or after treatment?
Barbell, thank you for the question. I think that's a great question. So I'm biased. I'm an immunologist. The most important thing I say today is your oncologist and your hematologist is your primary cancer doctor, okay? It's hard for me to say, Barbell or anyone else, that you should have an immunologist on the team. What is not hard for me to say is whoever you have managing your blood cancer needs to keep immunology and immune system questions in mind, okay? And the honest truth is some oncologists and hematologists do an amazing job of that, and they don't need an immunologist on their side. Some places, like where I am at Rochester, I work very closely with our hematologists. They, I think, appreciate my input, and I certainly don't step on their toes. They treat the cancer, but you can't just treat cancer, right? We don't treat parts of people. We treat whole people. We treat individuals. So when you're treating the cancer, that's great. That's the primary objective, but there can be collateral damage, right? So that's where I think I can help with some perspective. And the honest truth is, so some oncologists do a very nice job, hematologists. Sometimes if having an immunologist would be great. And the honest truth is, there's not that many immunologists in the world, especially in Europe, actually. It's just a couple dozen, actually, in Europe. There's not many, many more in the US. So the reality is you may not have access to an immunologist. So that's where this group is just such an eye-opener for me about the advocacy and the support you're providing each other. Because when you're treating blood cancers, you can't forget about the immune system, because unfortunately, the number one cause of death when you have a blood cancer is not your blood cancer. It's actually infection. I think you guys know that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and there's a reason for that. We can talk about it. So my very long-winded answer, Barbell, see, I can talk a long time, is you don't necessarily need an immunologist, but you want someone who's taking care of you to think about your immune system and address it. Because very importantly, it's not just a theoretical thing we're doing. There's actually things we can do to improve your immune system or protect you from infections, which is such
is that important after treatment or more important before treatment?
Great question. Both.
Both.
Your cancers themselves have immune suppressive qualities. Okay.
Okay.
Blood cancers are what we call B cell malignancies, B cell cancers. Your B cells make antibodies. So if your B cells are cancerous, they're not going to be as good at making antibodies. And we all know what antibodies do. They help fight infection. So when you have myeloma, lymphoma, CLL, SLL, you have a B cell cancer. So your antibodies will be affected from the cancer. We know that. And then you're treated with B cell depletion. Your B cells are kind of going crazy, making cancer cells. So let's get rid of your B cells. That's what rituximab does. And even medications like ibrutinib. So your cancer is messing with your antibodies. Now your treatments are messing with your antibodies. I mean, some of these treatments can have very long lasting effects. Again, I go back to rituximab. Even if you haven't had rituximab in months, sometimes years, it can still have effects. So really both before treatment, because you were diagnosed with this cancer, and then depending on your treatment regimen and all sorts of considerations during treatment and then after treatment. And all stages of your journey, guys, are not the same. For multiple myeloma, your risk for infection is very, very high in the first 2 months when you're diagnosed. So I treat that very differently than if you were diagnosed 20 years ago. So it's just a lot of thoughtfulness, but you just have to not forget about your immune system.
Can you test the quality of the antibodies?
Yes, you're asking such great questions. So I think you guys are so savvy, and I see some of this in the chat, my IgG level or IgM or IgA. That's the size of your army. That's the number of your antibodies, but it doesn't tell you about the function, okay? So you can check the quality of your antibodies. What we tend to do is do something called vaccine responses. We check a level for something like tetanus, and then we give you a vaccine against tetanus, and then we check the level again a month later. And good antibodies will increase those levels. And often people with CLL, lymphoma, myeloma will not respond to the vaccine. So sometimes even when their number is normal. So I'm looking ahead, Lisa, sorry, I'm skipping, but someone said their IgG is close to 1,000. That's good. The size of the army is good, but it doesn't tell me anything about how the army is working. Maybe they're lazy and sleepy and not doing anything. So it's reassuring. I like that you have an army, but you know, as Barbell said about the quality, that doesn't tell me about the quality, and I care more about the quality. You know, in myeloma, I don't think anyone on here has myeloma, but if you did, your number of your antibody is super high. It just doesn't work. So the number is a nice start, but really what you care about is quality and function. And yes, we can test for that. And I'm gonna be biased here. Sorry if this is recorded on Facebook. Hematologists don't often evaluate the function. They check the levels very well, but they don't often check the vaccine responses. Whereas immunologists do this routinely for this setting and others.
Thank you. So Barbell, I know you have more questions, so we'll handle more in round two.
Okay.
I think I'm gonna put, if you wanna throw something down there, that's fine, underneath round two. Our next question comes from Adrian. Dr. Adrian Warnock is the leader of our group, Shahzad, and he is going to ask his question now.
So my question is really along the lines, I mean, we sort of hinted at this a little bit. How is it and why is it that some people with certain types of blood cancers and at different stages of the treatment are more or less immune compromised? And, you know, what's the best way of looking at that and understanding that? I mean, you've already mentioned vaccine responses, but what about other blood tests and things? And how what does it matter as well? Like, once you know how good your immune system is, for example, does that make a difference about whether we should be going and watching a movie or going to church or working in a school, all those kind of things?
Yeah, great. Thank you, Adrian. Thanks for having me. Since you are organizing this to a very large part. So the beauty of humans is we're all different, okay? And we do studies on populations, but we treat individuals. So we are not good at telling you why my wife's breast cancer was much better handled than someone else's breast cancer, all right? We don't know that much, but there are some factors we know. So the type of cancer, Adrian, matters and your degree of immune suppression. And actually some CLL, which is often, some people think of a milder cancer, dare I say, or there's a lot more watch and wait therapy for CLL, right? Compared to lymphoma or myeloma. Even early in the diagnosis, there is often immune dysfunction in CLL. So the type of cancer matters. There's a whole host of other things that come from you, the individual. Age matters. We don't have amazing immune systems as children. We get stronger. And then as I'm getting older, my definition of older keeps changing. As we get older, our immune system starts dipping again. Later in life, 7th, 8th, 9th decade. So age matters, other comorbidities matter. So if you have diabetes or other things, that matters in your immune suppression. Medications can affect your immune system, and then chemotherapy regimens. I mentioned that those can affect your immune system on top of cancer. How many cycles of chemo do you have? How long are you on chemo? These things can all affect your immune function and lead to different responses. So although the vast majority of individuals with B-cell cancer will have some effect on their immune system, the degree effect can be very broad, from very little and not that meaningful to severely immunodepressed. And we can evaluate for that, Adrian. We can check immune globulin levels. We can check, am I feedbacking? We can check vaccine responses, I think is very nice. Lymphocyte subsets you can check. You can check counts of CD19, CD4, CD8. So we check those regularly. So that's kind of the bulk of the lab diagnostics. There are other things we do. We often look at imaging for the chest, because if you're having repeated infections, repeated pneumonia, repeated bronchitis, you can get changes in your lung structure. We check lung function, but that's kind of the workup. And this is why it goes back to my previous point. Why does it matter? Because you can have a normal immune system, and that's great to know. You can have little glitches in your immune system, or you can have a really, really big immune problem. And it isn't just theoretical. Beyond counseling of what we can do, what you should do, what settings you should go, concerts, movies, work, we have therapies. For individuals who have highly dysfunctional immune systems, especially antibody dysfunction, we can give you antibodies, right? You guys have heard of IVIG. You may not have heard of subcutaneous IG, which is the same thing, just given in a different way. But immune globulin replacement is used in individuals, and it helps. It helps protect them from infections. The most common treatment for preventing infections, especially in CLL, is actually antibiotic prophylaxis. Not big courses of antibiotics when you're sick, but low doses chronically to prevent infections. And that made a face. It's not benign. There's side effects. You have to consider it. You're always balancing, right? It's not just a theoretical thing we're doing for fun. There's a lot of intervention we can do. I'm going to be super rude here. And hang on, someone's ringing my doorbell. I'll be back in 1 second. I'm in the middle of my day. Okay, that's Zoom. Yeah, I'm on Zoom. Shut the door. I'm sorry. It's hard to find a spot to do this on a weekend. So it's not just a theoretical thing. We have medical interventions. Different vaccines, by the way, have different likelihood of response. For pneumonia, which is a really big problem, Pneumovax, PPV23, you're less likely to respond to that compared to Prevnar, PCV13. You should know that because I'm sure your doctors have given you Pneumovax, and I'm betting you didn't respond very well. So you need to know that there's another option, and you can check if you responded. You don't have to guess. So even the vaccines can come in. And then there is just counseling on risk mitigation, lifestyle questions, things like that. So much information can be gleaned from a good immune evaluation.
Thank you so much. So the next question will be presented by Seymour. Seymour, can you give your question, please?
Sure, I'm not sure which one to give. I had some general questions, but I just came up with another one. Why hasn't there been a study done on the effect of IVIG or SCIG on viral infections? Most oncologists will try to brush it off, saying, well, IG therapy is only good for bacterial infections. And what about fungal infections? Does IG therapy help for that? Why aren't they studying all this?
Yeah, so the first problem is there's not great studies in any of this. There just is not. There are studies that are published, and quite frankly, they're pretty suboptimal. I hate to be so blunt, but to date, our data, our literature is actually highly, highly undervalued, and we need to do better studies. So even the studies that show immune globulin treatment and CLL help some people, but not others, they just used a cutoff for IgG. Like we just talked about it. The level is okay, but it's not that good. So that's a very crude study that I'm not that impressed by. It was published years ago in the New England Journal of Medicine, which is so good, but we need better studies, okay? Immune globulin is antibody. It's a human blood product. People donate their plasma and you get their antibodies. We're being overly simplistic, Seymour, when we say antibodies help fight bacterial infections, which is what they do. Because our immune system has many parts and doesn't work in silos, it crosstalks, right? So there is impact on T cell immunity and viral infections, but the bulk of infection prevention you get with immune globulin is bacterial. Sinopulmonary stuff, lobar pneumonia, sinusitis, abscesses, staph, that is the bulk of what you're getting, but you probably get some improvement in viral immunity, not much in fungal. That's a little different part of your immune system. So the predominant prevention we're getting is bacterial, which is the biggest problem of life-threatening infection in B-cell malignancy. And I'm sad to say the studies are just not there. You guys have heard of Consider CLL. It's a study that's being considered right now to look at immune globulin replacement in CLL. It's hard to design well, and it's hard to get people to enroll in it. It's not an easy to do study, and that's another reason too. So lots of work
volunteer. Done. I'll volunteer.
Yeah, I like it.
And I also, I wanted to add that virus cultures or assays are actually pretty hard to do. Yeah. And they've only scratched the surface on viruses. I mean, there's a zillion of them. Yeah. And we don't know how much of the viruses we already have, like EBV and CMV, affect us in CLL.
That's correct. We have a lot to learn.
Yeah.
Thank you for that question. And now I messed up because I was looking
just
at
one, one follow-up on that, if that's okay, Dr. Mustafa. In all seriousness, we have about 800 members in our Facebook group alone, all sorts of different blood cancers, and then obviously lots of other Facebook groups that we kind of touch. Some of those will allow clinical trials. We will, and we actually put clinical trials on our website, and there we have sometimes up to, you know, we have around about 10,000 page views a month on the actual website as well. So it's certainly something, you know, among other things that can be used to try and track people. I think there's a lot to be said for Facebook ads and things for clinical trials, and it's surprising how few trials actually do that, but there we go.
I really appreciate that. And I will say, and I grew up on the other side of medicine. I have a younger sister who's chronically ill, and you know, my wife had breast cancer. The cancer community is a really special community, as you guys know. People's willingness to participate and advance the science is always very, very humbling to me.
For example, I think over Christmas last year, I was chatting to Brian Kaufman, who many people will know, in the US, and we were both figuring out how we were going to get onto the Evershield study. And we were both among the first patients to get onto it, actually. It was like, where is it? Where are the studies? And we were sort of letting other people know about that. And so a number of our patients that we knew ended up sort of ringing up and, you know, getting in there quick sort of thing. So I think there's a lot of enthusiasm if you touch into the right communities for those things.
That's great. And I will actually take that back. I'm pretty involved with that CSL Consider CLL study, which is a very important study of looking at immune globulin outcomes in CLL. And maybe I'll take that back to them, Adrian, just as a point too, because they're very worried about recruitment and hitting numbers. So great thought.
And maybe you can, you know, on the side, you can let me know if there's any way for us to get involved in the study. Later on. Okay.
I will.
I don't remember talking about that, hearing about that. Can we go on to Annette's question? Annette, can you ask your question, please?
Yes. Hi. My name is Annette. I've had CLL for approximately 10 years and have been in watch and wait that entire time. I'm the one with the high IgG, and nobody's ever been able to explain to me why my IgM is so low.
Good question. I don't have an answer for you either, but I'm to tell you what, it probably doesn't really matter. And I think words are really important in that. So we want to hit the right tone, right? It's actually not so low. It's just below the lower limit of normal. So if you're in the United States and you have this crazy speed limit of 55 miles an hour on the highway, you know, if you were driving 20, people would be honking and you'd get pulled over for actually being dangerous. But if you were going 54 miles an hour instead of 55, no one would really care. You're kind of going 54 on your IgM. It's not so low. It's just a little bit below normal. What would catch my attention with your IgM or your IgA is actually if it's undetectable.
Yeah, IgA is normal.
Yep. So I'm just saying in general for IgM and IgA, if it's undetectable, it affects infections and prognosis actually. But if it's just a little lower than what is considered normal, no big deal at all.
Okay,
I love that your IgG is in a normal range. That's very good. It's very reassuring, but it doesn't mean it's, you know, working perfectly like we've talked about. So that's very good news, though.
It's just all my oncologists look and go, huh, and they won't say anything about it.
Yeah, I mean, we're all unique individuals. You're made a little different. I don't know, you know, why do I have high blood pressure and, you know, someone else doesn't? So I think it's just our own variations.
This kind of, I'll just one quick question. I did have an extremely robust reaction to the Pfizer vaccine. So I just saw my oncologist about a month ago, and I asked about getting the Evershield, and he said, no, you don't qualify for it. Do you agree with that statement?
You're going to get me in trouble. I don't agree with that statement. So a robust response to the vaccine means the number of your antibodies is high, right?
Yes.
Here's the problem. No one on this planet as of today can tell you what that number means. I'll give you an example. When I look at antibody levels for pneumonia, I know above 1.3 is good. Below 1.3 is not good. Above 1.3 is good. I know that. There's no difference between 20, 40, 60, 80, 200. You just got to get above 1.3, okay? And what that tells me is your antibodies at that time. It doesn't tell me your memory. It doesn't tell me how long they'll last. So for pneumonia, it's 1.3. No one on this planet knows what that cutoff is for COVID. Is it 1.1? Is it 200? Is it 2,000? I don't know. No one knows. So you have to be very cautious. I do order antibody levels for COVID vaccine in individuals, but I caution them. If you see a level, that's reassuring. If you see zero, that's disappointing. But if you see a level, it doesn't mean you're good, because I don't know what level I should be seeing. We don't know that. And I don't know what that number will be in a week or a month or 3 months. So the level must be interpreted with caution. Any individual at high risk or not responding to COVID vaccination is a candidate for Evusheld. That is on the label. That's not my opinion. That's what it says. Or anyone who can't get a vaccine due to allergic reaction. So I don't need to tell you guys who's at risk for not responding to COVID vaccination. I'm looking at you guys. It's people with blood cancers, particularly on chemotherapy. So I don't mean to disagree with any providers. I'm not here to provide personal health information, but the level would not preclude anyone from getting Evusheld per the label or per practice for most individuals.
Okay, can I just have a follow-up question on that? Supposing you've got five doses in your fridge or whatever it is, okay? You've got five doses.
Evusheld?
Of Evusheld, yeah. Uh-huh. And you've got 10 patients in front of you who all have CLL. Five of those patients have got really low antibody levels or zero antibody levels in response
to COVID or in general?
Sorry?
For COVID or in general?
In COVID antibodies, okay. Yeah, COVID for the vaccine. So five of them have got either none or low levels, whatever that is, you know, lower numbers, yeah?
Sure.
And the other five have got really high levels. Would you give it to the five that had the lower levels or the zero levels in that instance?
I'd lean that way, but it'd be a little more nuanced. If someone with a higher level had been on ibrutinib, venetoclax, bendamustine, and rituximab, I'd actually probably give it to the person with the higher level on the higher level of chemotherapy. Depends on when they were diagnosed. If they were diagnosed 2 months ago, like someone said, I feel better than if they were diagnosed 20 years ago, because we know immune dysfunction and CLL progresses over time, generally speaking. So yes, Adrian, on a true false multiple choice question with two answers, I would lean towards giving it to the individuals with the lower levels, but I think healthcare, especially really good, thoughtful healthcare, is much more nuanced.
It's a tricky one, isn't it? Because yeah. here in the UK, for example, they put in a provisional order for 1 million doses of Hazenta when it was being developed. Evusheld when it was being developed. And then halfway through the development, they went flip. We don't think we can afford that. And so they canceled their order. And, you know, would they be better to get, say, 500,000 and target it to the people whose antibody levels are low? Interesting question on a sort of economic large scale like that. At the moment, they're saying, we just want to give it, we don't care. We just want to wait and give people antivirals or antibodies when they get sick. But obviously for us, we're only going to feel safe if we've got something like Evusheld on board, because then you get that sense that you've got antibodies, you know?
I completely agree with you. And you just took the conversation from medicine to transition over to public health, which is way out of my comfort zone. And it involves politics. It involves money. It involves decision makers that are not always scientists. You're very right. It's very complicated. I'm going to be very frank, because Lisa knows me. This is the way I am. I'm extraordinarily disappointed in the public health response to the immune compromised population, because Evusheld, for example, is a very effective and well-tolerated therapy. And the fact that we actually don't have more doses when it can absolutely be manufactured and purchased in a reasonable way is disappointing to me. At this moment in time, today, what's the date? Today is March 19th in the US. COVID numbers look very good. They can't even pass a COVID funding bill in our government. Let me tell you what, our numbers are not going to look that good 4 weeks from now or eight. It's just, that's the nature of this beast.
Well, so you say that. I mean, aren't we back to what Trump says? If we just stop testing, then we won't get the numbers. That's what my government is decided to do. They've now decided to stop the testing, apart from for immune compromised people, because then the numbers will look better, you know?
The numbers will look better. And I'm going to be frank. It's not wrong. It's a very uncomfortable thing to transition from a pandemic to an endemic. We're doing it and it's uncomfortable. You know, I'm not saying COVID is the same as a runny nose and rhinovirus. I'm not. But we don't test for rhinovirus because you just have a cold. Who cares? COVID is not that. It's killed so many people. But COVID today, 2022, is not the same as it was in 2021 or 2020. There are far more preventative strategies and therapeutics, even for immune compromised. So at some point, yeah, it's gonna just become second nature. You don't even test for it, you know, other than flu, you don't quarantine and you get treatment. We're not quite there yet. And it's a very uncomfortable transition. I don't know the right answer when we make that. But unfortunately, again, Adrian, in public health, there's a lot of politics and money and government. It gets really, really murky really fast. I do think strongly, and I want you guys to take this message away. I was very concerned for my immune deficient population if you got COVID a year to 2 years ago. Mm. I feel very good about individuals with CLL, lymphoma, myeloma, solid organ transplant, primary immune deficiency. If you get COVID today, most where you guys are looking, it looks like America and Europe largely, we have therapeutics where you will do very well. I want you to know that. We don't talk enough about the therapeutics. Lisa and I were talking, I was in charge of our therapeutics for our whole healthcare system, 17,000 employees. We have treated so many people when infected with monoclonal antibodies and now oral antivirals, and people do very well. So I'm very, very, very comfortable. My sister has immune compromise. She's on TNF inhibitor. She has seizures every day. I was really concerned. She's gonna die of COVID last year if she gets COVID. I'm not worried about her today. I don't want her to get COVID, but if she gets COVID, we have therapies available. So I want you to take that message away. And unfortunately, it's not that easy to find a therapy. Sometimes it really depends on where you are, but they are there. So this group is advocating. Adrian, you, Brian, you guys know about these things. You know, they exist. And I want you to hear that. If you get COVID, there are very effective, well-tolerated therapies that will do very well for you.
So, and I guess the important point, isn't it, is that those need to be given quickly at the beginning of the illness while you still feel quite mildly unwell, which can be a bit of a challenge because some doctors will say, oh, you don't look so bad, you know.
Exactly.
And I guess we need to go in and say, hey, Dr. Mustafa warned us that if we don't get treatment quick, we might deteriorate and might get worse. But here's my question for you in follow-up to what you said. You mentioned monoclonal antibodies and you mentioned the antivirals. And I know particularly the newest antiviral, the data suggests it's almost about the same as the antibodies. I would have thought we'd give both, but I guess that's quite expensive. But if you're sitting in a doctor's office and the doctor says to you, yeah, I can give you the antiviral infusion, civitumab, or I can't say the name, but that one, you know, the one that actually does work about Omicron. I can give you that, or I can give you this new antiviral. Absolutely. They've all got so horrible names at the moment, the one that begins with P. I can give you either of those, but I can't give you both. Okay, and you're an immune compromised person. Again, I wondered whether what your antibody level response to the vaccine might influence that, or is there any other thing
that
might
influence already. That,
or is it just flipping a coin? What do you reckon?
Yep.
What would you take? What would you want your sister to take?
Very importantly, I don't care if you're diagnosed with COVID and you feel good. COVID doesn't make you sick usually on day one or day two. We know this. There's a natural progression. It's really people deteriorate at day 7 to 10. We know this. I don't care. So anyone on this call, if you get COVID, you are a candidate for monoclonal antibodies or oral antivirals, a candidate medically. And if you feel good on day one or two, that's great. But that doesn't mean things won't change on day 7 to 10 when so many people, that's actually, you know, the virus is not the issue. We don't like the virus. The issue in COVID becomes our own immune response to the virus, our own inflammatory response. So that takes its days. As far as if you have access to both, Adrian and crew, it probably is a flip of the coin. They're both highly effective, but in the US, there are some loose guidelines. Guidelines are guardrails. They're not written in stone, but they provide some guidance. They actually say you should start with Paxlovid, which is a five-day anti-oral, antiviral. It's oral, take it at home, well-tolerated. The sotrovimab or monoclonal antibodies or infusions or injections. So a little bit more layer of logistical complexity. But these things are very effective, but again, they need to be used early in treatment. You don't get to get them on day 12 or anything. You've missed your window to intervene. We're not trying to fight the virus. We're trying to dampen down your inflammatory response.
And if you were a person who had zero antibodies, you knew you didn't make any, so someone like me, I have almost no B cells and almost no T cells either for that matter. And I never respond to any vaccines by making antibodies. And I'm actually on subcutaneous immunoglobulin, but I'm guessing there isn't going to be enough COVID antibodies in that to keep me safe. But somebody like me, my hunch is I'd rather go for the antibody infusion than the antiviral if I had the choice. But I don't know if that's a sensible hunch. There is a trial in the UK, actually, for any UK people on here, where you can take, if the NHS will give you the antibodies, and that does depend a little bit on the availability, but if they give you the antibodies, you can go into a trial to take an antiviral as well, which I think personally is what I'd really want to do. But my hunch is to go to the antibodies, but I don't know if I'm right or if that's just a sort of hunch.
Can I be honest? You're not right or wrong. We don't know. And I remember I started this conversation with, I promise I'm going to answer everything as evidence-based. As of today, you're not right, but you're not wrong. It's your hunch. You get to do it if you have the choice. And I want to say, immune globulin products, if you're getting immune globulin, anyone on this line, Adrian, you are, the product you're getting today was likely, depends on your batch, was likely donated about a year ago. Someone had their blood taken a year ago to get you the product today. That's the general delay, 9 to 12 months. So a year ago in the globe, many people donating blood had COVID antibodies due to vaccination or natural infection. So there is, and there are studies on this, detectable COVID antibodies in immune globulin products. Do not get me wrong, don't tell anyone Dr. Mustafa said I should be starting immune globulin replacement to get COVID antibodies. No. But if you're getting COVID antibodies, you're probably getting some, if you're getting immune globulin replacement, there's probably some COVID antibodies in there. You're right, Adrian. We don't know the level. Is it sufficient? Is it therapeutic? But it's trickling in. And pretty soon all immune globulin products will have it because our donor pool now universally has either been infected or vaccinated pretty much.
That is so awesome. I do need to, we want to get to everybody's questions as much as is possible. So we're up to our fifth person who has a question. And that would be Roseanne. Do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself and ask your question?
Yes, actually, it's going to change a little since you answered part of it. I was lucky enough after a lot of hard work to have the Evusheld. I want to know what exactly does that do for my life? Because I did have my antibodies measured only out of curiosity after got results last night. And for the first time, they're way up there in terms of the antibodies. But does the Evusheld make my army stronger? Or is it just making my army bigger, as you said? I saw your first presentation, by the way, which was wonderful.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm actually flattered that you came out of the pool for this. So thanks for joining.
I'm going back.
We're going to Florida in a couple of weeks. I look forward to it. Evusheld is literally insulin for a diabetic. Diabetics don't make insulin, so we give it to them, right? Vaccines are given to people, and then we rely on their immune system to make the antibody.
Right.
But again, Roseanne, and so many people on this line, if your antibodies aren't working well, if you have a B cell cancer and you don't respond to vaccines, Adrian said he doesn't respond to vaccines, he's not going to build antibodies to COVID from a COVID vaccine, right? So Evusheld is literally just injecting you with COVID antibody.
Maybe not strong antibody?
No, it's good. It's good and it's effective and there's great studies to show how well it works.
But what does that do for my life, doctor?
So the sexy part of what the company did is antibodies usually last about a month. If you get immune globulins, if you get IV, it's often once a month. You guys know this. They mess with the antibody, the Fc receptor on the IgG, AstraZeneca did for Evusheld, where they made it last 6 months. So honestly, Roseanne, what it does is it makes you close to a vaccinated person who responded to the vaccine.
But you also said be vaccinated, but act like you're not. Does that mean I'm still in the same position of having to be extremely?
I said that.
Yes, you did last time.
Oh, dear God. no, I'm usually quite the opposite. Listen, life is life. Why do we live life? I live life to.
I'm tired of being fearful here.
Okay, so I'm actually, I'm going to go back and look at what I said. I'm the guy, because I grew up with a very sick sister, and we tried to normalize it, because if you don't do anything, if you don't want to do anything, that's fine. If you like to be at home, that's great. But I encourage everyone here to do the things that they want to do with common sense risk mitigation. Maybe you shouldn't go to an indoor concert with 70,000 people tomorrow. That sounds a little bit aggressive. But please visit loved ones and don't miss weddings and birthdays and childbirths and grandchildren. I think that's why we live.
Travel too.
And again, it's not what you do, Roseanne. It's how you do it. It's how you do it. Yeah, please wear a mask at the airport, even if no one's enforcing it. And please wear a mask at the, on the airplane. But, go travel. I wouldn't maybe go to the middle of Africa right now at this moment, because, your therapies might not be there. It might be hard to get out if you get sick. It's how you do it. But I want everyone on this line, and I am such a guy about quality of life. Like, I don't mean to sound, glib, but the worst outcome in medicine is not always, death or something like that. The worst outcome is when you have no quality of life, in my opinion. And I'm not saying that right now. I think you guys are amazing and have good quality of life, but with treatments and prophylaxis, vaccines and Evusheld, and common sense risk mitigation, and treatments. If you get sick, I told you a little while ago, I feel pretty good about how we're going to take care of you. I want everyone on this line to live, do the important things, do the things that make you happy. I think that's very, very important. And I wouldn't have necessarily said that 2 years ago. I wasn't visiting my sister 2 years ago. We stood outside on the yard for her birthday. But now, no. I mean, and if Noreen, my sister, gets COVID, I don't want her to. But if she does, it's okay. We have therapy. So you can do a lot of things for a week or a month or maybe 6 months. Hell, we've done it for 2 years. We can't live alone forever. And humans are actually quite socially interactive. So I encourage us to do the things that make us happy in a safe, thoughtful way.
Thank you. I have one follow-up question. I'm the person that said about the 2 months diagnosis. In fact, I've had high white blood count and high lymphocytes for 12 years. People would say every time, and I get regular medical, several different doctors from several different states have said, oh, you have high lymphocytes, don't worry about it. Oh, you have something called CLL, don't worry about it. I didn't even know what it was. So finally, I had a pre-op for a knee surgery, and he said, you must see a doctor. And that's how I found it. Does that mean I've had it possibly for all this time?
It's hard for me to answer, but often, nothing starts the day before you're diagnosed, right? So yeah, you've had it for some time. I can't say how long. I take care of other immune problems. I just saw a guy 36 years old in the hospital who had a really nasty infection, and they consulted me for a drug allergy, the antibiotic he needed, he was allergic to. So I said, fine, I can take care of the drug allergy, but oh, by the way, why is this 36 year old have this really nasty infection? Can we check his antibody levels? He had zero IgG. So that didn't happen yesterday. He's probably lived with that for like a decade and finally got really sick. So yeah, I don't know how long, but you've had it for, some period of time.
Thank you very much.
Sorry, I see you stressing out these questions. I'm not making it very far.
I'm good for 3:30, though, I promise.
That's fine. We're almost done with round one. We're up to Leora. Leora, did you want to ask your question? Tell us a little bit about yourself. Thank you.
Sure. My question's kind of technical, but so I have CLL. I've been through two clinical trials. The third was venetoclax, obinutuzumab, and ibrutinib. And my oncologist, Dr. Bird, kept me on ibrutinib because of the symptoms that I had with my CLL, which deprived me of all quality of life. So I agree with you about that. But I have a lot of confusion because I see a local hematologist and an internist at the University of Maryland, because I live in Baltimore, who each independently have said to me, when I've said things about, well, at least ibrutinib like wakes up your T cells, they're saying to me, oh, but there's evidence that it interferes with your T cells crosstalk, like with the communication. So I'm in this like state of confusion. I know I have T cells because I get flow cytometry done twice a year. They're there. Are they active now, or are they like awake but not in communication with the rest of my immune system?
It's a really good question. T cells are a part of our immune system that classically and simplistically fight viruses. They communicate with our B cells, which make antibodies, which fight bacteria. Again, not being overly simplistic. Ibrutinib is really interesting because it has immune depressing qualities, but there's one study and a couple of other, one really good study and a couple of studies that say ibrutinib actually can restore your immune function, primarily through improving your T cell immunity, cellular immunity. So my answer to you, Leora, in general is ibrutinib can depress your immune system, but could also potentially restore immune function. There are ways to evaluate T cell function, not just the level, which you're getting with flow cytometry, level. It's called mitogen stimulation tests. Not many people do it. I'm not suggesting you go out and demand that you get it done, but mitogen stimulation tests are the analogy. Vaccine responses for B cells and antibodies, the analogy is mitogen stimulation tests for T cells. Almost like if anyone's in healthcare or has had a PPD for tuberculosis, that's like a T cell response. If you have a PPD, pull it on your arm and then you go back 48 hours later to have it read, that's a way to evaluate T cells. You can't get that if you don't have good T cells. So there are other things we can do, like a similar test, like a PPD, to evaluate T cell function. But I'm being very honest, most immunologists and certainly most oncologists, hematologists probably don't do that. But it can be considered. So it's a hard question. Again, everyone's different. Ibrutinib may have depressed your immune system a little bit. It may have restored your immune system. I can't say in general. There is a way to figure it out. It's not routinely done in clinical practice.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Leora, for that question. Our next person with a question is Denise. Denise, you want to say hello and give us your question?
Sure. I'm Denise. And I live in Minnesota. And I was diagnosed with cancer in 2012 and was told that, well, in 2013, I was told it was follicular lymphoma and was treated with R-CHOP. And so my treatment ended in 13. And not right away, but I was getting sick a lot after that. And like with pneumonia, or bronchitis, or sinus, and that kind of thing. And a friend told me about this herbal medicine called ECAC. And so I've been taking it for a long time. And what I noticed is that when I would run out, I would get sick, like within 2 days. So I continue to take it daily. And I upped it a little with the onset of COVID. So my question is, I hate being allergic, especially to dogs and cats. And because with COVID, everybody has dogs and cats. And some people have a dog and a cat or a pet. For every person in their family. And so I started taking Allegra twice a day, a heavier dose of Allegra, heavier than the over the counter. And still I get itchy and still I get an upset stomach. And so I was hoping to come on here and just hear that there's a solution for me that-
Denise, where do you live?
I live in Minnesota.
So yeah, this is veering a little bit from immune deficiency, but yes, allergists can desensitize you to darn near anything. So there are very effective therapies for allergy to things in the environment, like cats and dogs and dust and pollen and mold. We can desensitize you. You can take medications, but that doesn't get rid of the allergy, just covers up the symptoms. And it's annoying to take medications, even if it's safe. Immunotherapy, very different than cancer immunotherapy, is exposing you to your allergen, increasing the dose and making you less sensitive. And we do that all the time, all day long for cats and dogs and dust and pollen and mold. So Denise, I really encourage you to find a local allergist. There are good allergists in Minnesota and go see them and have allergy testing, identify your allergens and then talk about your options, whether it's medical therapy versus allergen immunotherapy, allergy shots. Absolutely.
Can I give a follow-up question to that?
Can I finish, please?
Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to say I had the latest scratch test, and I'm allergic to beef and peppermint. Those were my latest. And that's real frustrating too. So I'm going to go back to the allergist then, or maybe find a different one, because they really didn't help me other than.
Yep. I can't speak to your individual case, but I'm going to warn everyone. Allergy testing is not perfect. There's actually more false positives than true positives with allergy testing. If you diagnose food allergy based on blood work and allergy testing, you will overdiagnose it by 84 to 93%. The testing is not a yes, no. It needs to be interpreted very cautiously. You can be allergic to beef and peppermint, but those are very, very uncommon food allergens in an adult. So I'm not saying anything about your specific case, but I would be very careful that the testing is not a yes, no test. It needs to be interpreted. So yes, I would encourage you to seek out more allergy care.
Can I ask a follow-up question on that?
Yeah.
You mentioned about the desensitization for allergens. And I know, for example, that's often done to pollen, isn't it? Or to animals, those kind of things. And you often give the injection of the actual allergen under the skin. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but isn't it a little bit like vaccination? And aren't you actually making antibodies to that stuff and learning to tolerate it? So does it require your immune system to work? So would it work for somebody who doesn't make antibodies? Because it was suggested to me that it might not work for me because of that issue. So
that's a really, really sophisticated question. It's a little different than vaccination, because vaccination is kind of exposing you to something and then you make antibodies against it. Here, it's exposing you to increasing doses of the allergen and you actually become less sensitized to it. So you actually lose your hypersensitivity. The arm of your immune system is very different. It's a Th2 arm, Adrian. So we're talking about much more about mast cells and eosinophils and IgE. Notice on all these immune globulin things, it's IgG, IgM, IgA. We're not talking about IgE. With desensitization to, you know, cats, dogs, dust, pollen, it's IgE mediated. So it's a little bit of a different bear. But if you make no antibodies, you may have difficulty responding to immunotherapy for allergens as well. That is not well studied, very sophisticated. And a good question. I need to look that up, actually, if there's good studies on that or reports on that.
Thank you so much. Denise, are you satisfied with your answers?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
All right, appreciate it. Sarah, you are next. Sarah, do you want to introduce yourself and tell us your question, please?
Hi there. I'm from London, and I'm still, I should be on, there we go. I'm from London. I was diagnosed with CLL in 2016. I've been advised, my consultant sort of said they weren't very keen on many supplements, but they were quite happy about vitamin D. In the past, I was a registered osteopath. I'm now retired. So I used to go on a lot of courses, Solgar vitamins and whatever. And I remember a lot of discussion about coenzyme Q10, and that's cropped up on some of the forums. I just wondered if you had any comments on it. I'm wondering whether the fact that it's an antioxidant might be sort of relevant to having CLL, or maybe to be avoided.
It's a great question, Sarah. And this is one of the biggest unmet needs in medicine today, is well done studies on supplements and herbal medications. Here's my honest answer, and I'm going to be just straightforward honest. I don't know if they help or hurt or don't do anything at all. I just don't know, because the studies just don't exist. They don't. They need to be done. The lack of a study does not mean it doesn't work. It just means it hasn't been proven to work.
Yeah.
You need to do the studies. The problem with these supplements is they're in the US, not FDA approved. A company can make it and put it on the shelf. The supplement business in the US is a $1 billion business. So there is no benefit to a company making supplements doing expensive research, because nothing good can come of it, because they're already selling their stuff. So we need more information on this. There's a lot of stuff on probiotics, right? Also as well. I do know of one double-blind randomized control study of a probiotic compared to mesalamine, which is an anti-inflammatory in ulcerative colitis. And it showed that they were similar. So that's cool. Like if I had a choice between a drug and a probiotic for my inflammatory bowel disease, I would take the probiotic. I don't know. So I tell people for supplements, they cost money. So if you can afford them and you feel they help you, I think it's more power to you. But I do caution people, just because it's a supplement and not a prescription drug, and just because it's available over the counter, doesn't mean it's benign and safe for everyone. So just be cautious of what you're putting in your body. Some over-the-counter stuff, some of the more dangerous stuff we prescribe. So again, being thoughtful, what's the benefit? What's the risk? Be thoughtful. I think, you know, coenzyme Q, vitamin D, these are, you know, safe supplements. Do they have any meaningful improvement in your health? I simply don't know. And I wish we'd had studies to help me answer that. And this is a huge unmet need, because the world of herbal medication supplements in all conditions, cancers, asthma, allergies, it's exploding. So we need answers to this, and we don't have them today.
I've noticed a certain caution about things that specifically stimulate the immune system. There's a lot of things that friends will come and say, oh, I've got a friend who's got cancer, you should take this mushroom, whatever. and I know that possibly with CLL, that stimulating the immune system may not be such a good idea, because you might be stimulating other things.
Yeah, I'm an hour into my relationship with you guys, so I'm going to start being less politically correct and more of a jerk. I don't know of a single thing we can really do to stimulate our immune system other than, you know, vaccinations. Every day, our immune system is being exposed to thousands of exposures, whether it's the coffee that you drink or the gastrointestinal virus roaming around your community right now.
Yeah.
So this whole stimulate your immune system is a little bit, you know, I don't know if it's arrogant or bogus or what, but it's probably not really something we have the ability to do. Yeah. We can stimulate it with a trigger like a vaccine, and then you stimulate your antibody response. You can stimulate it with illness. If I get pneumonia today, my body will, you know, build antibodies and hopefully fight the pneumonia. But I don't know, and of course the stuff is advertised on social media and commercials of stimulating your immune system with X, Y, and Z. I don't really believe that's a thing. I don't think the immunologists do, to be honest with you.
Thank you. Yeah, that's fine. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Mustafa. Actually, the last question in round one is from Misty, who ended up having to work today. Misty has CLL. She is unmutated 17P deletion. And that's why I wanted to mention that. She's been on VNO, so she's currently taking venetoclax. And she's extremely sensitive to hot water, like, when, you know, from the shower. She literally will take Claritin before showers, and I think Benadryl. It's a weird situation, but it does seem to correspond with her treatment. Do you know anything about that? People who are having hot water or warm water reaction when they're on treatments, and do you have any comment on that?
Yeah, we're all covered in cells called mast cells. Mast cells contain tons of chemicals like histamine and prostaglandins and leukotrienes. And there are various things that can get your mast cells very excited to make them spill histamine to make you itchy and blotchy. Narcotics will do it. Has anyone ever taken a narcotic or gotten an epidural and felt itchy all over? It's not really an allergy. It's just kind of tweaking those mast cells. So if those mast cells get twitchy, you can have these like itchy red rashes that occur randomly. And there are various triggers. Increasing basal body temperature can do it. So exercise, hot water can do it, all sorts of stuff. And that can change during all sorts of stuff with exposures to background medications, stressors. If you're being treated for cancer, that is a physiologic stressor. The number one cause of hives in children, not you guys, but children, is a viral infection. You get a virus, and your mast cells get a little excited and they start spilling all this histamine, and kids get blotchy, red, itchy rashes all over. So I think that's what I'm hearing you describe. Yeah, it can be treated by a variety of medications, antihistamines and other things. And again, it deserves a discussion with the primary doctor.
Okay, that's right.
Absolutely. She just also heard didn't of, think- not uncommon, not freaky. This stuff is what we take care of all the time.
Okay, thank you so much. All right, we are on to round two, and I'm not ready.
All right. Can I just ask what kind of cells were you talking about,
Dr. Mast cells, M-A-S-T. cells. Okay. We're all covered in them. We have them on our skin. We have.
I just hadn't heard of them. So. Yep. Okay, useful. Thank you.
Lots of allergic chemicals, including histamine, which we know, antihistamines, but lots of other ones as well.
Doctor, at this point, I also wanted to ask you, like, how are you doing? And do you feel we can continue for a little while?
Or I'm good till 3:30.
Press break or anything? Okay, thank you.
My brother's in from out of town, so I have to hop off at 3:30, but I'm good until 3:30.
All right, and that's absolutely fine. Perfect. So Seymour, your next question seems to be a repeat kind of that we already talked about. Is that okay? Or sure. You want to ask it?
No problem. I have more questions. You know, I put them in the chat.
You can be here all day.
For later. Yeah, let other people ask, please.
Okay. And then Leora, you've got a question on there. Yeah.
It has to do with for people who got Evusheld before getting their booster of a COVID vaccine. The CDC recommendation is that you should go ahead and get your booster, even if you've had prophylactic monoclonal antibodies. My doctor at Hopkins has told me that they really don't know whether or not that's a good idea, so don't do it for now. And I'm curious, I mean, what they told me is that they're concerned that the proteins that the vaccine causes my body to create will just get latched onto by Evusheld. So it'll use up some of those antibodies and possibly abort my non-existent response to the vaccine. But I mean, I might be having a T cell response to the vaccine. You know, that the fact that I have all these antibodies floating around already could just mess everything up. And they're so for now, I haven't gotten a booster. I'm just curious if you have a feeling about it. I mean, they're basically saying they're looking into it, but nobody really knows yet.
Yeah, I think you guys can probably tell I have a feeling about most of these things, right? So all antibodies are not the same. Antibodies that fight infection, you know, are potentially, you know, Evusheld antibodies are not the same as monoclonal antibodies for treatment, which are neutralizing antibodies. So I'm going to be very honest, and I hate to be disagreeing with anything you've heard, but there is no reason not to be vaccinated for COVID after you get Evusheld. There's no reason to believe that. And the company is doing studies, and early studies show that there is no impact on future vaccination for COVID or anything else if you've received Evusheld. With that being said, you've been vaccinated 3 times, right, I think?
Yeah.
And it seems like you know you haven't responded. I don't know what the 4th, 5th, 6th, 8th, or 10th vaccination is going to get you. Is there a downside? Probably not to a 4th. Especially if you're not responding, your antibodies aren't functioning. But is there an upside? Actually, I'm not certain there is. There are some studies coming out, but it's pretty early. And I know that the CDC has recommended a 4th injection in people with immune compromise. I hate to be a jerk. I've done this a couple of times today. But they made that recommendation in the absence of good science. They assumed if 3 is good, 4 is better. You know what happens, guys, when we assume things. It's not usually a very good thing. So I recommend everyone get 2 injections and a booster. We know that. I recommend you get Evusheld if appropriate. The talk about the 4th dose, I'm really very ambivalent right now. My sister, I keep going back to her, like, you know, I care about her, right? She hasn't gotten it yet. I just don't know if it helps her. I'm not saying it hurts her, like you suggested maybe it's counterproductive of using up your Evusheld antibodies. There's no evidence of that. There's actually early studies on that, but I just don't know if it helps you. So people are like, all right, what's the harm then? Let's just do it. Let's get 4, 5, 6. Let's sneak in an 8th too. If you are responding to the vaccine, there's a concept of immune senescence. If you keep getting exposed to the same antigen, your immune system actually gets bored and stops responding. It's a law of diminishing returns. It makes sense, right? 1 vaccine's good, 2's great, 3's good. After a few, it is what it is. You just can't keep popping the same antigen. Your immune system is kind of burnt out of responding to the same thing.
So is that kind of what happens when you're treated for allergies?
In a way, different arm of your immune system. Different. So immune system, in essence, like I'm not saying a 4th dose is a problem. I doubt it is. I just don't know if it's particularly helpful. But there is a downside to just repeatedly dosing until the end of time. Sure. So I'd like science to guide our guidelines. And we're moving pretty fast. We're saying some things that don't really have proof of
Can I ask you something really quick on the back of that? Just really quickly talking about how many vaccines you've had. Yeah. So I had two before treatment. I've just finished a year of treatment, and I have venetoclax and inotuzumab. Had two vaccines before, had an antibody test, had some antibodies. Treatment wiped them out. So then I had a third, and I've had so over here we have three, we call them primary doses and a booster. So I still have no antibodies. But because I developed antibodies after the first two, my feeling is kind of if I'm offered another booster, then I'm going to take it, because I obviously did develop some antibodies kind of after the first two.
It's okay. And we're talking now, Sue, we're talking to you, right?
Yeah.
As an individual.
Yeah.
But I've been generalizing studies and
concepts.
So I have to talk to you as your doctor, and I'm not your doctor, but you have to sit in front of your doctor, and your decisions just, they don't apply broadly to recommendations. No.
Yeah.
So I don't, there's no recommendations on this scenario because you're a unique individual.
Yeah, for
you, I think that makes sense, and I would discuss that. But I was, when I was talking to Leora about just the fourth dose or beyond on studies.
Definitely.
They're just not there. I'm not saying it's wrong. I just don't.
No, I get it. No, that's wise. Yeah.
And I'm very cautious about assuming anything in medicine, because we get burned every time we do that. And again, I know the effectiveness of Evusheld for everyone on this call. We all do. It's very effective. So let's do what we know is effective rather than playing around with things that may or may not be. Of course, two doses, three doses. Leora, you said, right? T-cell responses, other parts of your immune system, it's not always.
Yeah, although the FDA is now saying it may only last for 3 months.
Yeah, I know.
And maybe only 1 month for the 1.1 version of Omicron. Yeah. And it changes like every day. I mean,
it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate. The speed of things is really, it's too fast right now. And unfortunately, it's actually faster than the science. So people are saying things and recommending things that aren't always totally sound right now. It's a tough time.
Guys, thank you so much. Now, Judy, Judy Richter, I just wanted to check with you. Is that a question? I take pentamidine breathing treatments every month. Do you have a question for the doctor? I don't even know if she's still on. Okay, guys, can we go to Robin? In the sake of time, Robin, you have a question again?
Lisa, could I speak to Judy's question? Judy has CLL and she's from Texas, but she's had the Richter's transformation as well and be treated.
I'm on now.
There she is.
Yeah, Judy, do you want to comment about your pentamidine breathing treatments every month?
I have been recommended and have had for probably 2.5 years a pentamidine treatment every month, breathing treatment to keep me from getting pneumonia. That's something that's common, or am I just, I've had two rounds of chemo. I had, when I first was diagnosed, I had benamustine and Rituxan in 2016. And then I had a large B cell in 2019 in my colon lymphoma, and had half my colon removed, and then had REPOC for 6 rounds. In the last 3 rounds, I also added venetoclax.
Yeah. So, again, infections are a complication with chemotherapy. All infections are not created equal. Pentamidine is a second-line therapy for PCP pneumonia. Typically, first-line therapy is Bactrim, sulfa-based antibiotic.
That's because I can't take sulfa.
Yep, so that's why you're on a second-line choice. And it depends on a whole bunch of risk factors, your T-cell count, your CD4, CD8. We do use prophylaxis against PCP. So I don't think that's unreasonable.
I was RMD negative and have just had a new test and are back to positive. So with my CLL, so hopefully it's not going to go, and we'll have a PET scan about a month.
I wish you well.
Okay, guys. I think your questions are all amazing. We do have quite a few people left. And Robin.
Do you want me, Lisa, do you want me just to, is it okay, just in the interest of time?
Oh, you want to just read them? I wasn't sure if we'd already answered Robin's next question. We've got a lot of
I'm going to answer Robin's question very straightforward. I do think everyone with B-cell malignancy should have immune globulin levels checked.
Okay.
I'm sorry. And many oncologists don't do it. It should be checked, regardless of whether you're having infections or not. So yes, that is a question, answer.
And Sally then I asked,
thank you.
Sally said she withdrew her question, so you don't have to read hers. Thank you. So the next one is Pat.
Yeah, could my autoimmune increase my CLL? So there's different parts of your immune system, autoimmunity, hypersensitivity reactions like allergies, and then malignancy. You know, autoimmunity does not really increase your chance of malignancy the way I look at it. It depends on age and things like that. This is a crazy thing, but some people with primary immune deficiency, their actual problem is immune problems, secondarily get cancers and autoimmunity. So if you get diagnosed with a cancer at an extraordinarily young, unusual age, 20s or 30s, and you have autoimmune stuff, I actually wonder if you have an underlying primary immune problem. That was undiagnosed that led to it. I see this all the time. I just saw a very young man for lymphoma at the age of 28. I was like, people get lymphoma, but 28-year-old, really? I checked his antibody levels before treatment and they were zilcho. He actually had a primary immune deficiency called common variable immune deficiency, which predisposed him to lymphoma and cancer. So I don't think the autoimmunity really increases CLL, SLL, but there are some considerations in the immune system. Sue also asked about irritable bowel and campylobacter and prophylactic antibiotics. We really try to avoid prophylactic antibiotics. We don't want to cause side effects, diarrhea, antibiotic resistance, but there is a setting where prophylactic antibiotics are used, particularly in CLL. Really depends on your immune evaluation and your clinical history, and I encourage you to talk to your hematologist, oncologist, immunologist. A lot of these are just comments now, Lisa.
Yeah, I know. I Seymour, we've got some other folks who asked questions who didn't get a chance. So I want to scroll past your question for just a moment.
No problem.
Sorry, I see other questions at the bottom, so I'm going back.
Answer Barbell's question. It's straightforward.
Yeah.
I see absolutely no utility in ordering IgG subclasses. I don't care. None. Doesn't matter in the world of immune deficiency. IgG1, IgG2, IgG3, IgG4. Doesn't matter. Just check in IgG. I don't think IgA even has subclasses.
Okay. We have a question from, I'm sorry about that. We have a question from Doug Michalak. It says, it's underneath being allergic to cats. are there ways to check? Are there tests available to see if antibodies for COVID are working properly, that the soldiers are intelligent enough to function properly in the immune system?
We can quantify our COVID antibodies, but we can't check for their function. But if you make them, I assume they would be working. It's hard to make antibodies against COVID that are non-functional. You make non-functional stuff, but if it's antigen specific, I assume it would work.
But I also wanted to add that I think that we have a stance for folks with CLL like Doug has, that we might not, we really don't know what it means.
Right.
You know, that's-
And we talked about that earlier.
I don't know if that goes with that. Yeah, that we still need to be very cautious. How about Maggie's question? It says, can CLL stop the pancreas producing enzymes, and can Creon work in someone with CLL?
I'm not an oncologist. I know CLL doesn't commonly cause pancreatic deficiency or insufficiency, but I don't know if that can happen. I would ask your oncologist, would Creon work in someone with CLL? Yeah, it should. Creon is, again, just giving the individual what they're not making. So yeah, I think it would work. But again, I'm not a CLL cancer expert. I kind of work on the periphery with immune stuff. So I'd ask your oncologist. But that's not something I commonly know of, at least.
Here's another one. This is from Esty. It says, I am interested in testing for food allergies and I have CLL. What tests are the best tests?
Or what you guys
tests
are combining my morning presentation and my current presentation.
I'll have to send you CLL. I'll have to send, put it out there.
The most important thing about diagnosing food allergy is the history. Allergies in adults are stereotypic, i.e. shrimp, I get hives. adults don't get chronic symptoms from allergies. So if you are not having specific symptoms from eating a specific food, don't go testing for food allergies, because all tests, skin tests and IgE levels in the blood for the food, will overcall food allergies. So only test for food allergies if you have symptoms suggestive of a food allergy. Never order a food allergy panel or anything like that, because you will almost certainly get meaningless false positives. Very important.
Awesome. Hey, I think we've actually gotten through everyone's question. Let's blitz them all at once with the rest of them that you were afraid to ask. Actually, I don't know if she sent me this. There was one more potential. Okay, never mind. And I thank you very much. I think, there's another message. Oh, excellent Q&A. Thank you so much from Troy. Thank you. We really appreciate you. We're wondering if we can keep seeing each other, maybe 6 months or so from now. What do you guys think? Can we have a round of applause? Take it off of mute for a second and let's have a round of applause for Dr.
Listen, guys, it's a privilege. It's a privilege to do what we do for a living, and it's a privilege to take care of individuals like yourselves. So thank you. Thank you for being advocates for yourself and for the community. Healthcare is not delivered by just physicians, NPs, and PAs. It's delivered by you guys and you talking to each other and advocating for each other. Adrian, I wrote your name down, and Lisa, when I talked to the CSL bearing people for Consider CLL about reaching out to folks you.
Yeah, let us know. We'll publish something on it and get you some people.
Thank you for joining me on a Saturday in the evening in Europe and on a Saturday here in the US as well. But I would love to do it again. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you for being with us, guys. So, for anyone who's new here, don't forget bloodcanceruncensored.com is our website. We have a Facebook group, Blood Cancer Uncensored, also Facebook page, Blood Cancer Uncensored. And obviously this weekly Zoom call. This happens every week. Most weeks we normally just chat and be friendly. But thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Misself. It's been wonderful.
Thank you so much, guys. Have a good day.
Bye. Bye-bye. Bye now.
Bye.
Bye.